This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/Keith Bergun. Hello, and welcome to episode 10 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Bergun. Today, I'm going to be talking about design and how it's kind of the science, very soft science for creating value. It's coming out of a bunch of conversations I've been having recently regarding game design discussions on the internet, and also some other conversations I've been having about improvisation and a few other things. So if you've ever talked to someone who's kind of like a science denier, someone who doesn't believe in global warming or thinks that vaccines cause autism or, you know, just whatever, on whatever topic, they just don't accept the scientific consensus, you'll often hear them bring up as a reason for why they're skeptical of scientific findings the fact that science has produced incorrect results before. And, you know, this is something a lot of people have talked about, that you know, obviously science is a process. It's not a source of information. It's not like a single person. There is no the book of science, and it is, you know, X percentage right and X percentage wrong. It's a process, and of course it is going to be wrong often. The thing is that it's still, even though it's wrong often, it's our most reliable way for figuring out what is true and what is not true, or what is more likely to be true and what is not more likely to be true. So I think that, you know, design, the idea of creative design, is a very, very soft science, and it's kind of the same thing. It's our best tool for figuring out what we should do with our crafts. In the same way that science is the most reliable tool to figure out whether a claim is true or false, design is the most reliable tool that we have for creating a machine that produces value, for creating art, for creating crafts and songs and story and games. I'm talking a lot about design, but I also wanted to kind of talk about the opposite of design, and that's sort of this idea of improvisation, or a kind of mystical belief in a human being's off-the-cuff, you know, from-the-hip choices. We tend to kind of glamorize and glorify and romanticize the choices that someone makes when they have no time and they just kind of like choose it. The classic example is improvised music, probably. That's probably one of the most embraced examples of improvisation that I know of. There are things like that. There's improvised theater, and there's improvised paintings that are, you know, that somebody just like splatters a bunch of paint down and they just kind of do it all in one take, and then they don't go back and revise it or anything like that. It's sort of this experience, and it's an experience, I guess, for the artist, and that's supposed to be significant to us on the other end. The problem with this whole philosophy of improvisation and embracing improvisation is that ultimately, we, the person on the other end of the beaker, or looking at the painting, or playing the game, or whatever we're doing, reading the book, we are sitting there, we don't know anything about your process, and your process doesn't really affect us directly. The only thing that affects us is the actual arrangement of information that's hitting us. So the rules that are in the game, the lines and colors and shapes that are on the painting, the events that are in the story. Now, I want to make clear that I'm not arguing that context doesn't impact the player's perception of whatever information you're presenting. Of course, when you're creating something, you have to factor in the context, and you have to consider who your audience is going to be and how your message will be received. But we can kind of just like factor that out, you know, because we're talking about what arrangements of information within a given context. So let's take the context and let's put it aside for a second, because I think some people tend to think that so-called formalists don't think at all about context. And I definitely do think about context. I mean, a word means what it means because people understand it to mean something. So my point is just, you have to consider context, of course, but for the purposes of this discussion, let's table that for now, because that's a given. That's a granted. Whether you improvise or heavily design, you should be considering your context, the context of in which your art will be consumed. There's this idea that something can be over-designed. And to take it back to the science thing for a second, I've heard people say things like, you're overthinking it, that something can be thought about too much. And there are practical reasons why, of course, someone could think about something too much. You know, like they could forget to eat, or they could not get enough sleep because they're thinking about it all the time. So there are practical limitations on how much you can think about something. But in terms of determining whether it's right or wrong, I don't think there's such a thing as thinking about something too much. Another way you could maybe think about something too much is if you are thinking about things instead of doing other things that would give you that information more effectively, like actually doing research or looking at the findings of others who have researched this heavily, you know, not reinventing the wheel. There's a lot of things you can be doing beyond just, you know, pure thinking. My point is that there's no point of amount of thinking that will cause a problem, because you can always go back to original thoughts. I mean, you can have, you know, belief X about a certain thing and think about it for 20 years, and you can kind of come back to the original thought that you originally had on it, because even after all that thinking, that first thing still kind of makes the most sense. So I think people sort of think of thinking and of design as kind of this linear travel, and the truth is in one spot. And because you're constantly traveling, you're going to like eventually just leave that point, and you're going to just go out into some weird direction. But you know, the reality is that you can always just kind of stay in that one spot. You don't have to keep moving around. Thinking doesn't mean changing your views, and it doesn't exclude you from reverting to old views. So I don't think there's such a thing as overthought, and I also don't think that there's such a thing as overdesigned. People will point to things that they think are overdesigned, but they're actually just badly designed. Before I go on, I should just quickly kind of give my little definition for design. To me, design is intentional, creative choices that a creator makes for his work. So, you know, choosing how many hit points your monster has is design. The opposite of design, something that's not designed, is when you don't consider things, and when things sort of go in because that's just how they are, because of some automatic thing, or because of something that you didn't consider, or because of habit. Anything other than like something that was considered, I would consider not design. So, you know, for example, if you threw a bunch of sand on the ground and all the particles flew all over the place, I would say that's not design. Like where each particle of sand is, because you can't really control that. Now, if you went back and you micromanaged each little piece of sand, then that's design. So that just hopefully will get across my basic premise for what design even is. So people will talk about things that have been over-designed or overwritten. I studied music in school, and there is a common idea of music that's overwritten. And similar to the thinking issue, you can't really overwrite something, because you can always revert to the first thing that you did if that ends up being the best thing. And doing that is a design choice. The idea of something being overwritten just really doesn't make sense. I will say that with more choices being made, there are more opportunities for bad choices to be made. And so I can see why people would sort of be skeptical of a very long design process, because they're like, oh, this person, you know, people make mistakes and they're just going to be making all these mistakes all over the place. And yeah, that's true. But at the same time, they're also going to be making good choices, and they're going to be learning about their system, and they're going to be making the kinds of choices that they couldn't be making at all if they hadn't been spending all that time sitting in the design and understanding its problems and its strengths. So for example, with my game Oro, like, it's had already a 5-year design process, and there's just so many things about the system that revealed themselves to me as throughout that process that I just would have been completely unaware of if it weren't for that design process. There's just all this information that you uncover in a long design process that allows you to make better design calls. That doesn't mean that you won't make bad design calls. You absolutely will, and everyone does. But in terms of actually pursuing, how are we going to pursue better designs in the future? Long design processes and intentional, careful design is the most reliable way to get that, despite the fact that many designs will end up just being bad. Now, there is a kind of spectacle value, novelty and spectacle value of, oh, wow, they did this all in one draft. Or, wow, they did this like up on the stage right in front of me. And this is an original solo, guitar solo that no one's ever heard before because they're making it up as they go. And there is some novelty value to that. But I mean, people generally tend to understand that like novelty and spectacle are of lower value than the kinds of values that these sort of forms can deliver. But all of a sudden, it seems like we appreciate those spectacle novelty values heavily when it comes to something like improvised music. And I think that there's some sort of cultural weirdnesses going on there. It's sort of related to museum culture and people's general insecurity about, well, if I pretend I've talked about this before, like, you know, people who feel like they have to pretend that they get it or else they're going to be seen as stupid. So even if something is just like kind of like a bunch of random notes or a bunch of random splatters on a page, they have to sort of be like, yeah, no, I totally get why this is like genius. And it's, you know, there's a lot of cultural reasons for that. We have a lot of, I would say particularly in America, there's a lot of romance for sort of individualism and a person's individual choices. And a lot of that is healthy, coming from a healthy place, but it kind of goes into a weird place when talking about these issues of like design and craft. You know, it's not good enough that something came out of you. It's not good enough that you just did something and that you're an individual and that, you know, you have your own experiences, and the first draft stuff that you spat out is different than the first draft stuff that someone else spat out. We should be embracing people's individuality, and people should be comfortable with themselves, and we should certainly not be trying to, you know, hammer down the nail that sticks up. We should definitely embrace our individuality, and I think that is a good thing. It's a healthy thing, and that's all good and positive. However, this first draft culture, it's my experience, therefore it has value thing, is not in our best interest. So that's something I've talked about before, that, you know, that some elements of the like realizing ourselves and, you know, self-positivity and those kind of movements do have negative side effects, and some negative side effects. I mean, I think we still are on the whole better off for having them, but there are some downsides. And one of these downsides is this idea that everyone else needs to just accept my first draft thing that I made. And, you know, they kind of can't even be critical of it because it's just, it's me. I would say actually something that is heavily, heavily designed is even more you, because like every one of those choices is bringing out something about your philosophy. And I think that people are kind of scared about that. I think people probably are kind of scared that, oh yeah, but if I start, you know, kind of like trimming off the edges and like taking feedback from people and processing it and stuff, eventually it's going to like myself will be lost. And I don't think so. I think that a person's self is extremely complex, like just crazy, crazy complex. And even in like, you know, decisions that seem like, oh, I took someone's advice, you know, someone else gave me the advice to like, I don't know, cut this note's length by a little bit or change this thing or, you know, change this red color to a bit more of a magenta or, I don't know, change something about the second act climax. Even when we take people's advice like that, we're still doing it or not doing it based on some kind of underlying philosophy that we have that's, you know, complicated, very complicated. And so I don't think it's very hard to like lose yourself actually in a work. If you're the one making the final creative calls and you're the one, you know, even if it's a years and years, years long process, I still think that you are coming, your philosophy is coming through probably with more and more clarity actually. Because when we do something that's like first draft, a lot of things that we do are actually kind of automatic, and we do a lot of things based on expectation and sort of vestigial ideas. Not all of it's us, you know. It's like once you're questioned about a choice, a creative choice that you've made, then we start seeing who you are. It's like only once those creative choices are actually questioned, because there's a lot of things that just happen sort of automatically. And that just, you know, come out of someone's mouth, or that come out of the guitar when they just start playing. There's physical things that they feel comfortable doing. And you might argue that those automatic things are them too. But I think that there's a deeper them there that comes out when they're challenged and when their choices are questioned and when they have a moment to sit there and reflect and be like, is that really what I want to say? Is that really what I think? I think that you're seeing more of a person there. But regardless, that's all sort of a sidebar, because the point is not whether it expresses something about you. Even if it expresses nothing about you, the objective is to deliver value to others, to point something out about reality and to deliver value, to deliver some kind of intellectual value to people. So yeah, I think there's some kind of mystical thinking about the improvisation stuff. And I think we tend to think of overly designed things as these cold, impersonal, not real, not as real, not as sincere things. When in fact, I think just the opposite is the case. I don't know if anyone has read my recent article about the Practice 2015 conference that I attended, but this kind of spirit was very strong there. And I haven't talked about this yet on the podcast, but there was a lot of elements of this kind of anti-thinking. We had a discussion about whether there could be truth in game design. There was like a big open floor discussion. And, you know, someone asked, like, what does it mean for something to be true or false in game design? And this relates to the whole design concept. I brought up that it's the same as anywhere else. It's like what works, what has been shown to work, and what seems more likely based on information that we have to work in the future. And that's how we start developing guidelines and all that kind of stuff. There was resistance to that idea, of course, and some brought up, well, you know, there have been people who thought all this stuff, basically people gave the same science denier argument, but like kind of in disguise. I remember one person, I don't remember who said it, but one person stood up and said something along the lines of, well, you know, our whole reality is kind of determined, written by the winners, and, you know, events that we think shape the world, they happen differently than the way we know it. And basically, they gave this whole, when we think about like science and stuff, we're hearing the winner's version of reality. And so a friend of mine actually kind of stood up and said, so you're saying that they're wrong, you know? And that, to me, that's the key point there, is that they are actually making another like empirical positive or negative statement about reality of the world. They're saying the reality is not the way they're saying it's a different reality, is a different way than what we've been taught. And that is still another positive statement. And that people don't seem to kind of get that. That kind of happens a lot. And that kind of comes back to a point that I make all the time, which is that these kind of design calls and these guidelines and stuff, we all have them and we all use them. It's just that we're not honest about that. Like we're ashamed of it. And we kind of try to, we all have like best practices in mind. Even though it's like very early in the game design world, even game designers already have this kind of stuff going on, and they just kind of don't want to admit it. And that's the problem, I think. This all kind of comes back around to a fundamental thing about this podcast and what I want to do, which is talk about guidelines for better design. And by the way, I understand that I'm having a lot of meta discussions recently, and I would like to get a future episode to be much more in depth on a specific game design guideline. So I do plan on doing that in the future. It will be more craft-oriented and less philosophical going into the future. But I do think that some of this stuff is, these big topics, are worth going into from time to time, and particularly up front, because it's sort of setting the groundwork for other stuff. And of course, you know, if you want more practical hands-on stuff, I definitely recommend check out 3-Minute Game Design video series on YouTube, and also, of course, my website at keithbergon.net. To sort of conclude, this is a bit of a short episode, but to conclude, design is the best process that we have for figuring out how to create value and to do so reliably. So we shouldn't be ashamed of it. We shouldn't be ashamed of having conversations that seem old. Like, there's another thing that I wanted to talk about really quickly. There are conversations that happen on Twitter where people are complaining that other people are asking questions about like, you know, what is a game, and like, what does it mean to be indie? And there's all these kind of questions that are old, and I can imagine how they're annoying and frustrating for some, because they've been talking about that question for years and years and years, and there hasn't been a consensus answer yet. But I do think that most people understand, have a basic understanding of a lot of these questions, and progress has been made, and progress will continue to be made. And we shouldn't be, it's one thing to not want to engage in those kind of discussions, I totally understand that, but it's another thing to kind of paint those who are working on those problems as like below you, because I already had that discussion for a long time and I got bored of it, and you're like way lower level than me because you're having it now. The reality is that we're continuing a discussion that's been going on for a long time, and that's how progress happens. To wrap up, design is the most reliable way to create value, and to the extent that something is improvised, it is not designed to that same extent. So, you know, I am against improvisation. I would not recommend someone improvise something or somebody do something in one draft. I think we generally have a pretty good understanding that, like, if someone wrote an article in one draft and just did one draft and that was it, that we would all be like a little bit skeptical of that, rightfully so. And if there was some writer who was like, yeah, I always do one draft, we would probably also be like, that's a little strange at the very least. And that's a good thing. There's nothing magical about your first take. If your first take, you kind of ended up getting some things right, a lot of things right, maybe you got 100% of the things right, then you have nothing to fear from a design session of design. Yes, you might take some right decision and make it wrong because you were more looking at it more closely. You might turn it into something that's like less of a good decision. That can happen. But that is the same risk that we take with science and trying to figure out whether a claim is true or false. For example, someone might just have a gut reaction and think, oh, that food is bad for me. And then we might do some science and the science might say, oh, actually, this food is not harmful for you. But then the person eats it and it actually was harmful for them. And that's all that means is that bad science was done, not that, you know, that science in general, the process of science is bad. Like, we should still continue to do science. And in the same way, we should still continue to do design, even when design leads to failures. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider becoming a patron by going to www.patreon.com/KeithBergon. Thanks for listening.